Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio O in Newtown, Pennsylvania. In tonight's episode, our 48th, we finish up season 4 with a recap of our field work on the island of Cuba. Stay tuned for Notes from the Crocodile. Joining us again is geographer Johnny Finn, who came on board with episode 32, Hasta la Habana Siempre, to discuss how Cuba enters into the North American geographical imagination. Tonight, he helps recap and revisit fieldwork that geographical imaginations made to the crocodile-shaped island back in the spring. We welcome Johnny from his office in Newport News, Virginia. Last time we spoke, I finished episode 32. We were talking about the North American imagination of Cuba, and I threw out this idea that I might walk the length of the island. Maybe I didn't even say I would do it, but I said, what if someone was to do it? And since then, since we spoke last, I attempted to do it. About 6 months ago, I went to Cuba and with the idea that I was going to walk from the easternmost point to the westernmost point. I got there to Punta de Maicí in the east. You know, I walked, let me count, 5 days before, wow, between the temperature and the surface and a good dousing of rain, my feet basically got so blistered that I actually went to the hospital to get them treated, part because I didn't know who to go to in terms of how to navigate the healthcare, yeah, system, but also part because they were pretty serious. So I started like all walks, kind of excited. We had spoken about logistics, you and I, before, you know, so I went all excited. But I like to think of it in, like, my feet rejected it. My feet said, this walk is not going to happen. And,
oh, man.
Yeah, it was the worst blisters I've ever had. I mean, I was bandaged and had to hobble around the town of Moa, which is a very industrial sort of mining town on the north coast, east of Holguín. It's like the furthest town in the province of Holguín. And
yeah, I see it.
I was laid up there for 4 or 5 days between treatments. Yeah, I went to the burn unit of the hospital to get treated.
Oh my, Kevin.
Yeah. Which a blister, blisters are burns, right? I mean, it sounds worse, but anyway, so yeah, the walk just didn't happen, but that didn't mean I was going to give up on exploring Cuba. And
sure,
so,
yeah, sure.
So I wanted to revisit with you a little bit today, I guess, this, you know, my own imagination of Cuba and some of the things that I noticed and to hear kind of your take on those.
Sure.
So this is one of the things I did pick up, and I really like this idea of the geobody. And so the shapes of countries tell us something, or they get ingrained in our minds. And for for Cuba, and I heard this a couple of different times, one from a geographer that I met in Havana, which we'll talk about maybe a little bit later, but the idea that the island looks like a crocodile.
Yeah, sure.
And I like that. So I walked the snout, essentially, and maybe got to like the forehead or where the eyes are of the crocodile, but didn't walk further than that. I did travel, though, kind of extensively between there and then back to Havana, which I guess leaves out the tail. So head of the crocodile and maybe some of the spine and through the center.
Right.
And so, yeah, I guess the first thing is the hospital. It was interesting. I was received differently, right? I'm not from there. So
right.
I had to pay separately, even though paying for my treatment was very cheap. It still was something that maybe an everyday Cuban wouldn't have afforded.
Right.
And I was brought to a different room then and didn't have to wait as much as other people, but received the same sort of professional care. Someone who took off all the skin around my blisters and then left, I'll have to show you pictures one time, but left the feet essentially raw. And then they had to heal, which is the best treatment for them. But
right.
It basically left me losing. I couldn't walk again. I mean, I'd have to wait a month or two to get my feet back to where they could be.
The long distance walking.
The long distance, yeah. But even like walking around, it was difficult for those first couple of days. In fact, I was told to just stay in bed.
I know that in Cuban medicine, they assign bed rest a lot more frequently than I'm accustomed to bed rest being assigned in the U.S. I'm not quite sure why, but that doesn't surprise me at all that they just said to stay in bed.
Yeah, and of course, here I have this momentum to want to go and travel, whether that was by foot or then just sort of give up on the idea of the walk, but still travel. Yeah, I was stuck in Moa. Where the internet connection's actually quite good. You go to the plaza, and I was able to at least kind of keep in touch with people and fill in people on what was happening with this walk that it was stopping.
So I have a question for you, Kevin. How was the, when you say like the you just went in and you figured you had a little bit different treatment in the hospital, but it was mostly...
Yeah.
Mostly what you imagine is just kind of Cuban medicine. How was it? How did you feel about the treatment that you received?
Excellent. I mean, I had to get it, in terms of the actual medical treatment, I had to get it through my head that the walk was over. So that's not their fault. That's my fault.
Right.
Kind of pushing the feet when I should have probably stopped early on and let the feet heal a little bit. But I actually thought... the care, in the space where the care was happening in this burn unit was great. Techniques were, I mean, I've never had this done before, but definitely someone who was well trained. All of those things. I mean, that didn't surprise me. I kind of expected that. I'd say the facilities maybe. No, the facilities were good. I guess the building that I happened to go to, maybe it needed some reforms or some rehabilitation or something. But
it wasn't a separate hospital for foreigners. It's just whatever the regular old hospital there in the town that you were in.
Yeah, it was the hospital, and
yeah,
I went into sort of the administration first. I was lucky to have someone kind of help me as well. Just went into the administration and explained what was happening. And within minutes, I was sort of being attended to. Whereas, you probably have seen yourself, the normal citizen probably is waiting in line much more, maybe spends a whole day there to get treatment.
Well, I think it depends on a lot of, like, on several different factors. I think it can go either way, and I don't know that specific hospital, but whenever I've interacted in outside of Havana with kind of the medical system, I've always found almost exactly what you're describing. And I can't remember me personally being sick or something happening that I had to go, but I've had to take my kids to the hospital or to doctor's offices in Cuba before.
Yeah.
And I always was like, basically the exact same impression that you've said, that I've been in rural areas, you go to the nearest policlinico or hospital or whatever, and the buildings are usually a little bit run down, maybe a little bit run down is an understatement, but the attention is super professional and obviously very, very highly trained, highly skilled professionals doing the work. And I found that actually, similar to you, and I don't think it was because I was a foreigner, because my wife, who's Cuban, was with me, and the treatments usually happen really fast. And I think it's just because maybe in a more rural area or a smaller city, there's not the kind of the taxing on the medical system that you have in, say, Havana. But then the flip side of that is, I know my mother-in-law, when she has to go every 6 months to have a, because she's a cancer survivor, and she has to take some MRIs and some X-ray scans, and she has to take the imagery and have it analyzed at the hospital, the big hospital in Havana, the Almohades Hospital, which is the largest hospital in Havana. And the way that works is you get a appointment for one, like, the day to show up, and you have to show up early in the morning and just wait all day long until they call your name.
And that's what I felt like. I had the fast track around that. That's the only difference maybe that I saw. And I feel bad, but at the same time, I didn't want to spend my whole day in the hospital, so...
I guess what I'm saying is, I'm not sure that you could probably get a sense of it seems like at that particular hospital in Moa, if there was a lot of people around waiting, if you kind of got slipped through. And we might have talked about this before. My general impression of the Cuban system is that the infrastructure is, the Cuban medical system, that is, the infrastructure is pretty run down and in need of some updating, but that the human attention in the human capital is extremely high, extraordinarily high, really.
So I went in probably what we would consider like an emergency room kind of setting initially, and very different from my emergency room experiences here in the States. I had full confidence in the people that were taking care of me. I never felt like, oh God. And I've been in other countries traveling around where medical care or dental care, and I've not been as, I don't know, trusting and confident. Yeah.
Right.
And so that was good. I mean, I felt like, okay, this is just what happens. I pushed my feet too far, but here I am in a place where this is going to get taken care of. Another country in Latin America, that might be a different story.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition.
This is something that came up, talking about other Latin American countries, and we're always quick to make comparisons about places, right? And are we doing, when we compare, say, Cuba to the United States, is that not the right comparison to make, but perhaps to compare it to other Latin American countries that have a shared cultural and colonial history, obviously the language, but beyond just the language, the Spanish presence and the colonial experience that Latin America has had. Is it better to compare Cuba to other Latin American countries about anything, whether that's medical care or the state of their economy?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question, and it's a really kind of it's a politically loaded question, because generally speaking, the Cuban government is oftentimes very quick to compare themselves very favorably to the rest of, for example, Latin America or the rest of the post-colonial world, and make the argument that they shouldn't be held to, measured on a metric compared to, say, Western Europe or the U.S., because they're a former colonized territory. They're not the former colonizer, and that their political economic system has done them much better than other former colonized territories. That basically they say you need to compare apples to apples.
Right.
But that comparison, if you're in Miami, for example, in a group of Cuban emigres or Cuban Americans, that comparison is basically not tolerated as a line of argument, because there's a pretty strong I hesitate maybe to use the word nostalgia, but speaking of the kind of the American geographical imagination of Cuba, there is also a Cuban American geographical imagination of what Cuba was in the 1950s, right?
Right, right.
Before the revolution, and where I think the comparison that you're more likely to hear in Miami, in the cafes on Calle Ocho, are comparisons of Cuba now to Cuba, or to the social memory of Cuba from the 1950s, rather than Cuba now compared to other post-colonial Latin American countries. And so I think how you answer that question is really...
It's tricky.
It foretells your political perspective in a certain sense. From a geographic and historical perspective, I think it's actually a more apt comparison to compare it to compare Cuba to other kind of historical or other countries with similar historical and geographical contexts. So comparing it to Dominican Republic, to Puerto Rico, although Puerto Rico and Cuba diverged after the Treaty of Paris in 1898, or to compare it to other countries in Latin America that are in some way more similar, kind of in the geographical and historical context. But maybe, again, that maybe gives away my kind of political perspective. But I don't think it's an accurate comparison to compare Cuba today to a very fraught memory of what Cuba is said to have been in 1957, let's say.
Yeah.
That was a long answer for that, but...
No, but that's, here's another one, too. Fidel Castro, before passing away, says, I don't want any monuments that show my bust, my face, my head, I don't want statues.
Yeah.
And yet we see across the cultural landscape of Cuba, José Martí all over the place, right?
Yeah.
Now... What's the difference between, and I think it probably fits into that sort of Miami geography as well, and those spaces there, and how people look at Cuba. What's the difference between a narrative of Cuba that has Jose Marti at the forefront as the hero versus Fidel?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because there's so much going on in that question. I think I'll start by saying that's the right question to ask, and I think part of the focus from the Cuban kind of from inside Cuban perspective is the focus on Jose Marti kind of has the rhetorical effect of bringing together the Cuban fight for independence from Spain, the anti-colonial fight in the last 30 years of the 19th century, and the revolutionary fight that Fidel led starting in the mid-1950s. And so in an interesting way, I think, and I'm totally spitballing here because I haven't actually thought of it very much, but it occurs to me that the focus, I've oftentimes thought of Fidel Castro's kind of saying that he doesn't want to be, you know, any statues or busts of Fidel. And he was like that in life as much as he was like that in death.
Okay.
I always thought of it kind of this false, what's the word I'm looking for, this false modesty, because the persona of Fidel Castro loomed so large in Cuba. It was just so incredibly, like, person-centric, that to say that he doesn't want a bust or say that he doesn't want a statue to him, it misses the point that it's such a Fidel-focused political and cultural system. So I always thought of it as kind of a, like, in simplistic terms, perhaps, a kind of a false modesty.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, what I'm thinking now in terms of the way that you've asked the question is, it doesn't change my conclusion, but it, maybe when you add in the dimension of Jose Marti, it adds a little bit more depth to it, that he, and I think it's true, and he would say so in his language, that his anti-U.S., North American aggression, North American imperialism, as they call it, his fight against North American imperialism is, when couched in terms of all the busts of Jose Marti that are all over the island, it's kind of seen as a continuation of the anti-colonial revolution of the 19th century. So in a certain sense, the Cuban Revolution, the 1959 revolution, is in a certain sense, it's made to be only a continuation of the anti-colonial revolution or battles for independence of the 1860s through 1890s, seen in that context, I suppose.
Yeah. So it's a continuation of that narrative, that revolutionary narrative, the anti-imperial. Do you think the Cuban American it's obvious to me, but maybe I'm missing something, but they seem to place Jose Marti at the center of their narrative.
Yeah, sure. So the thing about Jose Marti's poetry is that it was apolitical enough that it can be easily adopted for all kinds of different ideological purposes. So it can be, Jose Marti can be cited for kind of anti-capitalist purposes, and he can also be cited for kind of individual liberty and free market purposes. So because I think his poetry was rather, at least overtly, it was rather apolitical. Not all of his writings, but it was his writing was, it's not that he was apolitical, quite the contrary. However, outwardly, just the words on the page were perhaps abstract enough that they could be put to use in multiple different political contexts.
Yeah.
So Marti is put to use by the Cuban revolutionary government post-1959 for their, like, it's put to ideological work. Marti's work is put to ide- ideological work for the Cuban Revolution, but it can equally be put to ideological work for the anti-Castro Cubans in Miami, because it was the work itself was abstract enough that it wasn't kind of blatant political arguments. It was romantic poetry, right?
Right, and it even then gets turned into, one of the top exporting songs about Cuba, Guantanamera, right?
Right, exactly, yep.
I mean, that's coming from his poetry. Now, there's a statue of him on the top of Pico Turquino, which is the highest point in Cuba, in the Sierra Maestra.
Right.
And it was brought up there by the young revolutionary who then wound up being part of the core group with Fidel. But her and her father carried a bust of Martí up to Pico Turquino in the mid-1950s to sort of mark this, or late 1950s, to mark the sort of revolution and putting him on the highest point of the country.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of a symbolic placement, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so
what's so interesting is that there's also a big statue of José Martí on the south border of Central Park in New York City.
San Martin is there as well, one of the liberators from Argentina, I think.
Right.
It's interesting what statues are on the south, Central Park south there. They are...
Because Martin did spend a lot of time in New York, and he spent a lot of time in the U.S. fundraising for the anti-colonial movement in Cuba, the anti-Spanish colonial movement. So it's not completely random, but it is when you're talking about Martí on the top of Pico Turquino in kind of southeastern Cuba, it's just an interesting juxtaposition to think of him there. It's actually in New York, it's a huge statue of Martí on a horse on the south end of the Central Park South. So.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program or radio essay expedition that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode.
So a little bit of a shift in, I don't know, I saw it as like this shift from a very local or regional sort of cultural practice of playing baseball to what a lot of people are talking about now is the youth are maybe more interested in soccer. And is that the FIFA and the World Cup effect? Is that people are seeing it more on TV now. How is that a shift from what again, in my imagination, Cuba is all about baseball. That's its sport. Maybe even more so than the United States in some ways. The United States has multiple sports, baseball being one of them, and maybe the most important. But I think there's other sports too that challenge it. Whereas in Cuba, in my mind, that was the number one sport. If you're an athlete, besides maybe, I guess track and field or boxing, there's others too. But but baseball was the, is king. Is that shifting?
Right. So that reminds me when you mentioned like track and field and boxing, and I would also mention volleyball. In terms of Olympic like history, Cuba has been in the last 50 years very influential in volleyball. And I have a family member, one of my wife's uncles, who now lives outside of Cuba. He's very critical. He's a dissident, a Cuban dissident. He lives outside of Cuba now, and he says about Cuba's history of sports, he says you can tell that it's kind of a Soviet style imposition of athletic prowess, because like with boxing or with volleyball or with track and field or with these other sports, because when you go out onto the street, you don't see anybody playing volleyball. I've never seen anybody playing volleyball in Cuba except for the Olympic volleyball team. You never see anybody, running, like, doing the track and field this kind of thing is not popular. But Cuba's very good at it. And to him, this was an indication that it's been kind of a Soviet-style, top-down, centrally planned sporting economy in a certain sense. The difference, though, is that with baseball, that's not true. Baseball used to be, anyway, seen everywhere. It was a very popular sport, and I think you're absolutely right in saying for a long time it was kind of, and at least still today, at least in the terms of the American geographical imagination of Cuba, it's the national sport of Cuba. But more and more, especially amongst young Cubans, I think, and I teach a course on globalization. We focus a lot. A big chunk of the course is on cultural globalization. And I think that Cuba is more and more inside these networks of globalized and globalizing culture.
Yeah.
That they're more and more exposed to like global cultural markets. And so in a certain sense, the same thing applies to music and film that applies to sports. Because, for example, the Cuban group or the Cuban singer Decemer Bueno and Gente de Zona are now globally massively popular and have been made to become popular along these, that has been enabled because of the increasing connections between Cuba and this kind of globalizing cultural force of the international music industry. And the same is happening in sports, I think, that soccer, you're right, is becoming much more popular. In Cuba, it's played on the street a lot more. I don't know if you noticed the last 5 years or so. I've noticed a lot more kids playing soccer than baseball. It used to be when I first started going to Cuba 20 years ago. It used to be all baseball all the time, and kids would play baseball with like a little bottle cap and a stick, or they'd make a baseball out of like wrapping up old fabric and tying it into a tight ball and using whatever kind of who knows what as a bat and playing it just on the street. And now all of that's converted to soccer. And I almost never see baseball being played, and you see soccer all the time being played. And then just while I'm talking about this, I remember the 2014 World Cup that was in Rio? Was that the one in Rio?
Well, all around Brazil, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, it was all over Brazil. But I remember it was like the semifinal match or one of the quarterfinals, I don't remember, that Brazil was playing Germany.
Oh, right,
in the World Cup game. And this is that famous one when they went down like 1-7, and Germany scored, I think, like 6 goals against Brazil in a super short period of time. And I was actually in a train station in Havana, and there was like dozens, maybe even more than 100 people crowded around 2 or 3 different TV screens watching this World Cup game of Brazil versus Germany. And I thought that was really kind of telling in terms of the cultural interest in sports, where there's in Cuba in a train station, people are gathered around watching the quarter. I don't remember if it's semifinals or quarterfinals. Watching the game of Brazil, Brazil versus Germany, game happening in Brazil, and Cuba's not even participating in the World Cup, and still there seemed to be this kind of tremendous interest. And I remember when Germany just in a couple of minutes scored goal after goal after goal, and people, Cubans were visibly kind of saddened, and they kept saying, oh, the poor Brazilians, because they were just getting creamed on the field. But I think I only go into tell that story because I think it's kind of emblematic of this changing interest in Cuba towards soccer. But all that to say that Cuban baseball players are still making it into the upper echelons of Major League Baseball in a way that, in terms of soccer, Cuba is still in the global soccer industry. Cuba is it's not a part of it at all.
Right. They're not going to be putting up a team or qualifying a team to the World Cup anytime soon.
Yeah, and they're not exporting players either the way that Cuba still does export baseball players to the big leagues in the U.S. Cuba's not exporting, at least not yet, exporting soccer players into, you know, teams in Europe or whatnot.
Yeah.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
I actually went to where the grandma arrived and almost, you know, sunk, or did partially, I suppose. But that region there, I was checking it out. It's not a region you drive through on the way to anywhere. You have to go out of your way to get there.
Sure.
And this was after going up. I did actually go up to Pico Turquino. I figured if I wasn't going to walk the length of Cuba, at least I was going to go to its highest point.
The hike
on my own feet.
Yeah.
So I did that, but then wanted to check out some of the sort of just look at how Cuba remembered, right, and was remembering these different moments up in the Sierra Maestra. You can see where the camp was for, you know, the bearded ones, and then down by where the grandma, which is the boat that left around Tampico, Cuba, Mexico, sorry, and made it over, and missed maybe its original point, or anyways, this is where it arrived, and I wanted to see how Cuba was remembering it. What do you think in general about the memorialization of the sort of the revolution?
Yeah, there's a huge effort. There are huge efforts to kind of etch into the landscape this revolutionary history, whether it's murals on the walls or on the streets or on billboards, or whether it's the memorialization of places all over the city of Havana and all throughout the country. There's a really strong emphasis, and I've written, as I'm sure you know, I've written a bunch about landscape and the way that landscape becomes an important avenue for the creation of social memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Cuba, as much as anybody else, perhaps more than a lot of countries, really does use memorialized landscapes for the, and I'm using the word production and creation on purpose for the production and creation, or we could call it the reproduction and ongoing recreation of social memory. Because most people who lived through the revolution aren't there yet, but the way it's remembered is oftentimes deeply influenced then by the landscape, not necessarily by direct experience, right? And so the landscape becomes a really important part, a really important way that social memory is preserved and kind of perpetually recreated. So sorry to get all academic on you right then.
No, but that's kind of, I was trying to figure out, especially around Sierra Maestra, the narrative being shown. And it's interesting, less so in the mountains. I think it's just a little bit harder to get to. But more so down at the Granma, which is right off the road. I mean, you could show up in a tour bus, which there were many tour buses of Cubans sort of going out. Some looked like a couple groups were teacher groups, maybe being trained. And doing professional development and seeing this to then bring back to their classrooms, but then just other tour groups that were national, and they were really, I mean, as you would imagine, someone from the United States going to, I don't know, I live near Washington's Crossing, where he crossed the Delaware right now, and the same sort of, I don't know, solemnity that someone might go to a site like that. In terms of the national story, and yeah, it was interesting, I guess, to see the Fidel's village, if you will. I don't think that's my term, and not theirs necessarily, but up in the mountains, it was definitely a lot of. There were probably more because it was part of a trek, and it was probably geared more to a foreign audience.
Right.
But not exclusively. I mean, definitely the tours were done in English and things like that. So the group wasn't Cuban. Doesn't mean that Cuban groups don't go. But
right, sure.
My particular one was like English speaking. And yeah, I mean, you just get a sense there, too. And there's a museum up in this sort of village, and you see in their first radio station that they had. And it really just gives you the sense of, I don't know, I guess how big it was what they did. And it's framed that way for as few people as they were, what they were able to accomplish, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's the narrative, and that's the story that's being told.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think that gels, I haven't been to that particular spot, but that gels a lot with like what they're doing at the Bay of Pigs Memorial and Museum. And they have this wonderful billboard, this gigantic billboard right outside of the Bay of Pigs Museum that says that this meaning this place, was the site of the first success, I don't remember the exact language, the first anti-imperialist fight in Latin America. But somehow towards the U.S., like the first anti-U.S., anti-imperial battle was won right here in Bay of Pigs. And you go in, and it's totally framed in terms of this ragtag band, in the case of Bay of Pigs, the ragtag band, this brand new military that Fidel was commanding, and, you know, winning against. These highly trained, they used the word mercenaries. Yes,
yeah, yeah.
They used the word the mercenaries. This highly trained band of mercenaries that's backed up by the most powerful military in the world, and this kind of the ragtag Cuban army was able to defeat them in this first battle of anti-imperialism, and, you know, against the U.S. against imperial U.S. in Latin American history. And so they really do work, I think, work very hard to frame it that way. And then the museum is set up that way. And that totally gels with my experience. Yeah.
Thank you.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
Here's a snapshot, and this maybe goes back to this idea of making comparison to other Latin American countries. I've worked in rural Paraguay and rural Ecuador, and I wouldn't say that your typical campesino, as we might say, would be reading a newspaper. I saw that more than once in Cuba. And someone working who probably didn't have access, you know, this is me going by kind of fast on a bus or something, but someone who probably didn't have access to mechanized, you know, tractors and such. So definitely like a small scale, low tech farmers in Cuba taking a break and reading the newspaper in the heat of the day. I wouldn't say I saw that in Paraguay or Ecuador.
Yes, I guess what you're saying is the kind of the juxtaposition of what you would assume to be kind of the most likely social class of people to be illiterate, meaning kind of subsistence agricultural workers, like obviously not illiterate because they're, and not only like literally they know how to read and write, but they're partaking in kind of the civic engagement of reading a newspaper, right? That's really kind of the one of the big. And again, you always have to take these kinds of things. You should always with what I'm about to say. You should understand that this is the line of the Cuban government. But one of the things that Cuba did very early on in the revolution was major literacy campaigns.
Yeah.
In the early 1960s, to the point that the United Nations actually declared Cuba to be the first Latin American country free of illiteracy, sometime in the early, like by 1963 or 1964. And so there's this strong, and we hear about the Cuban educational system, and it certainly has faults, but one of the faults is not the access to primary and secondary education, and it's almost unheard. I can't think of a single time in all of my experience in Cuba of like knowing or seeing like people dropping out of school or something like this, including in rural areas. More common is in rural areas, because transportation is a problem. A lot of kids go to boarding schools. So, for example, my wife, who grew up in a very rural area in central Cuba, starting in seventh grade, she went to boarding school. And so she would take a public transit to get to school on Monday morning, and she'd stay there for 2 weeks and come home on the Friday 2 weeks later.
Oh, wow.
And have a weekend off. So every other weekend she would spend at home. And this is going all the way back to seventh grade, like starting in seventh grade all the way through high school. She was essentially in public boarding school. Those public boarding schools are much more common in rural areas because it's hard for students to travel long distances to school, and it's also hard for teachers to travel long distances to schools. So the teachers, many of the teachers and all of the students would live at the school itself. And that's how you can see, I think that's one of the important ways that you can see that including the rural poor in Cuba, including the rural agricultural workers end up, their children very easily become perfectly literate, and they maintain kind of famously high levels of literacy for when compared with the level of economic development in the country.
Well, this marks the end of the episode.
the end for now of our expedition into Cuba, that crocodile-shaped island in the Caribbean that was for so long terra incognibilis, or land unknowable to me. Not just terra incognita, land unknown, but unknowable because of the political relationship between my home country and it. We've done 5 episodes now about Cuba. Episode 32 with Johnny Finn, we called it Hasta la Habana Siempre. In episode 36, La Arquitecta, we discussed women architects' role in shaping the new Havana. In episode 46, we sat down with poet Jose Poveda and talked about puentes, or bridges. Episode 47, we met with Enid Rosales, a songmaker from Havana. And in tonight's episode, episode 48, we revisited some of the notes from our trip to Cuba in the spring of 2018. And with episode 48, we arrive at the end of season 4. Looking forward to our new season, season 5, starting next month in 2019. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next year.